The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library. My name is Andy Cahan, and I am very excited about our guest this evening. Oh my, is there nothing this Nani can't do? Her award-winning talents transcend all media and devices, from the big screen productions of Merchant Ivory to the flat panel in your living room showing EastEnders, Law and Order, or I Feel Bad, to the most elegant thug you want to hug who fits in the palm of your hand, to cultural ambassador and cookbook author and memoirist. But the more I say, the less time you have with her. Tonight, our guest will be interviewed by my former colleague, a lover of books, cooking, her mother's idli, and all things Jaffrey. Please welcome Anousheh Bala and Mador Jaffrey to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Hi.
Hello.
Welcome to Philadelphia. We are so lucky to have you here with us tonight. It's a huge understatement to say that you are have had a huge impact on the world of food, on the world of the arts. You have over 20 cookbooks, maybe more, actually.
Maybe more
than that, and numerous film and television credits, and your career has spanned nearly 50 years, and we could talk all night about all of that, I assume. But since you're here tonight for your latest cookbook, I thought we could start with how you got your start in cooking. I understand at age 19, you moved from India to London to begin school at RADA and longed for a taste of home, a taste of your mother's cooking. And so you asked your mother to mail you recipes, is that correct? So you could learn how to cook. Could you tell us a little bit about those recipes that you got and how they inspired you to start cooking?
She knows everything already. I was talking to her in the dressing room, and she knows everything that I know and more. So she's totally
amazing. I'm a huge
fan. She's totally amazing. So I was like anybody else when I left India. I had not learned how to cook. My mother had not taught me. And because we didn't need to know how to cook. We were sent to school, we were sent to college, and not sent into the kitchen. They said, you go study, and we'll take care of everything else. So I had not learned anything. And this was now, you have to know the period, this was the middle of the 50s. And I was just a raw student coming to England, but knowing everything about England from all the books we'd read. We weren't ignorant about England. It wasn't just like a kid from India just thrown into England and not knowing what to expect. We'd seen every movie. We'd read all the literature. We had been brought up on Dickens and, you know, writers, classical British writers. So we were familiar with the country and its people and its traditions. But somehow I was not familiar could expect the smog that was there. This was just after the war. So there was a pea-green smog that descended at 3 o'clock. So that was one thing against where I was landed up. The other thing that was against it was the food. Now, this was, again, after the war, and I was studying at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, so we would go to our canteen for lunch, and when we went upstairs, there would be this kind of roast beef that had been cooked till it was gray and sort of sitting in mashed or boiled potatoes and cabbage that also looked gray. It all looked like the same color. And I would sit there just dreaming of my mother's potatoes with asafoetida and cauliflower with potatoes. I would dream about these things, and I said, I can't cook. And how will I make these things? There were no good Indian restaurants anywhere to be seen. And they were so terrible. They were not regional in any way. They were kind of generic Indian, where certain spices, which to me tasted the same, if you supposedly got a curry madras, as they called it. Sorry about that. It was tasted just a little bit hotter because madras was the hottest curry. Vindaloo was next in heat, and korma was mild. It didn't matter. Kormas can be very hot in India, depending on where you eat them. But the dishes were sort of had a there was an idea of a dish there, and an idea of it being vaguely Indian, but wasn't Indian in any way that I could recognize. So it was really something that the British had to go with the beer that they were drinking. The whole idea was cheap food to get the beer down, as much beer down as you could, and then you eat this hot food to make you drink more. So that's the time I landed in England, and all Indian restaurants were terrible, and I said, this won't do. So I wrote my mother, and I said, could you please send me some recipes? And I asked for these specific recipes, like the potato and cauliflower, etc. And she used to write me very economically on those aerograms, they were called, air letters, those thin air letters. And in Hindi, she didn't write English, she didn't speak English, my mother. So these would come in Hindi, and there were three lines of little recipes. Take a little bit of this, add that, and then roast it, or bhuno it, as we would say in our language. And then it's done. Taste and it's done. So I said, how, you know, that sounds very simple. So anyway, this is something that I then realized years later, maybe in the 1990s or 2000, around that time, I began to realize that I must have had a very good palate. I must have had taste memory of some sort, because when my mother sent these three-line recipes, how can you cook from them, actually? But I must have remembered how it tasted. So I took her the spices she used and the vegetable she used or the meat she used and somehow put them together to get the taste that I remembered. And she didn't provide me the exact road to that taste, but my memory did. And so I was able to recreate the dishes. And then when people started asking me, tell me how you cook this, or how did you make it, I could write it for them as if writing for, well, not idiots, but people who don't know. And I was one of them. I was the first one who learned that way. So I said, I will tell them more. I will tell them, okay, so you keep frying it on a medium-low heat. My mother never said how much heat, what size pot. So, you know, you could go wrong any time. But I wrote it for people who I said, I can make them understand what I finally figured out. That if the pot is much larger, it won't work. If the pot is much smaller, it won't work in the same way. But if I tell them, take a medium-sized frying pan and then put exactly how many tablespoons of oil and stay on medium heat or medium-high heat or turn the heat down and cook the onions till they turn brown. Now, don't worry, they're going to look very brown, but keep going. Let them turn brown. So I wrote in a way that I think began to make sense to people who are cooking the food for the first time. And I think that's why my books sold. So I learned from my mother, but also very helpful for me was my own memory of the foods.
Absolutely, and I think that one of the things that makes your books so special is the voice that you have, where you really make the reader, or if you're watching on television, the viewer, feel like they can succeed, that they can do this.
Yes.
And it's encouraging, but never patronizing. And I just think that's such a wonderful thing to be able to feel like you can do it and do it the right way.
Well, I think, and also I never studied cooking. So I am like everyone else. I'm sure some of you are better at me at this. I can't chop onions fast. If I try, I'll chop off my finger. I do it like a housewife, you know, I do it slowly. But what's wrong with that? You do it slowly. And in fact, one of the things that Ayurveda tells us, that all these things like cutting and chopping and slicing, these are graces that help move the soul upwards. Now, you don't need to remember that or know that, but if while you're chopping onions and your soul is moving up, why not?
I just love that. That's a wonderful thing to think. I am a I am a fast mover, and so maybe I should slow myself down
to
allow my soul.
Oh, no, you can do it fast, but the rhythm is the rhythm.
Okay. Yeah. Did you have help in finding your voice as a cookbook author? Was your editor helpful, or is it just all you? It's all natural.
No, it just was me, the ignoramus, writing for you who perhaps don't know much more. But I will help you, and I will teach you. And I will teach you as much as I know. I can't teach you more because I don't know more. And I started by writing about the food of my family in Delhi, because that's all I knew. I didn't know the food from her part of the world or any other part of India. I just didn't know it. And I learned it slowly over the years. And as I learned, I worked very hard on it. I'm a hard worker. I'm a perfectionist. And then I put it in my books. So I was learning as I was teaching.
That's so wonderful to hear. It's nice to have somebody who wasn't cooking from a super young age.
You know? No, I could cook when I was two.
But it's a great thing to hear that there's still hope for those of us who are just starting to learn how to make some of these things. I understand that you travel a lot and that you explore the world. Where have you been lately? What are you enjoying learning about and cooking these days?
Oh, wherever I am. It could be Italy, it could be Morocco, it could be anywhere. It could be the Philippines. And I think I started writing for Gourmet magazine pretty early on, and I started writing for them because it gave me an opportunity to travel and learn. So I would just say to Gourmet, could I write on the Philippines? And if you said, could I write about Italy, they would say, no, we'll find somebody else who doesn't look like you to write about Italy. But if I said the Philippines, they didn't know too much. Nobody knew too much about Asia and the foods of Asia. And so they would say, go. And I knew absolutely nothing about the food of the Philippines. But then I would start right in New York, finding people from the Philippines to talk to learn from. Everybody had a friend that was from the Philippines, and then they introduced me to other people. And so I started my research. The research has always been a wonderful part of my writing. I think I almost prefer the research to the writing, and to learn from other people. And I also realized that the best way to get recipes is to go to wherever you're going, and go into homes. Don't go into restaurants, because they will neither tell you the right thing, nor will they be able to provide a recipe. And you don't learn, because restaurant food is not necessarily local food, though it can be. It can be, but that's not always the case. So go into homes. And also, when you go into a home, they'll say, oh, I'll write the recipe for you. And I always say, no, don't write it. Just make it for me. Because, again, there's so much more you learn by watching. And again, you learn by watching how do they cut the vegetable. It makes a lot of difference what shape they cut it. Then again, it's, are they cooking on high heat? Are they cooking on low heat? How long do they cook this? How long are they really browning, whatever they're browning? So you actually, and I don't carry cups and spoons with me, but I have a sense now that she's putting in about a teaspoon of salt. So I'll write about a teaspoon of salt, and then I'll check it when I'm testing it myself at home in New York. And I learn so much more by watching people cook and hearing what they have to say as they're cooking. For example, I'll give you a funny example. I was in Hong Kong, and they were cooking those long beans for me. I don't know if you've had them. And I just picked up a bean, as I do always. I just rinsed it under the tap, and I ate it. And there was shock all around by the Chinese. You're eating a raw vegetable? And I know why now, because if you read the history of Chinese food, they used human waste in the fields. And there was no history of anyone picking up a raw vegetable and eating it. It was always cooked, at least slightly cooked. It was never raw. They never ate raw vegetables. There are no salads in those recipes from China. So it was something I learned, but I discovered it by just eating a raw long bean in a kitchen in Hong Kong. So there's so much you learn by being there, by watching how people do things. And then I remember one also has great adventures that one can write about afterwards. I remember going to the Philippines during, I don't know how many, some of you are old enough and would remember, Mr. Marcos were in power at that time. And so I wanted to, I had heard that Mrs. Marcos actually loves to cook for her husband. One of her, they were called blue ladies, the ladies in waiting. One of them had a daughter who knew my daughter, you know, something like that. So I found my way to the palace in Manila. And there was his office and her office, and people were waiting to see him and to see her. And I waited one day all day, and it was like 5 o'clock, and they said, okay, they're going home now, as it were, and you can go home too. You come back tomorrow. So I had to come back again and wait. So I went back, and there was Mrs. Marcos sort of lying back on a love seat like this, and there were tears coming down her cheeks, and she said, I feel so bad for my people. So I thought, oh, this is interesting. And so I said, I'm only from Gourmet. I mean, I'm only writing for Gourmet. I don't, you know, I'm sure you're doing great things. So I would like to, I've heard that you cook. She says, oh, yes, I cook bananas flambé. And I make it for my husband all the time. And then she talked in Tagalog to her maids at the back. And she said, do you want me to make it for you? I said, I would just die if you would make it for me. I'd be so happy. And then she talked again to her maid. She said, oh, I'm so sorry. I can only make it with Chiquita bananas, and there are no Chiquita bananas in the palace today. So I never saw her make it. But then I went again when the Marcos were out of power. And then I stood in line to go through the whole palace. You could do that, you know, you could go through the whole palace. So we went through the same room where I'd been through and back in the kitchen. And there was a kitchen, a little kitchenette. And then we went into her bedroom. And I said, well, I wonder what cookbook she has. So I started looking through her cookbooks. And that was recipes from American First Ladies. That was one of the books in her bedroom. And then we went and saw all the shoes. We went down, and I said, I must see all the shoes now. And literally, there was a huge room with shelves and shelves and shelves of the same pump, but in every different color imaginable. So with food, you know, food doesn't exist in a vacuum. It comes attached to people. It comes attached to geography. It comes attached to stories, lovely stories. So I love collecting the stories and putting them in my book as well. Yeah. I don't know where I started, but anyway, this is where I finished.
I love hearing that. I feel like for a lot of people, their first exposure to a foreign culture is through its food. And it's such a wonderful thing that we have so many different foods that are available to us here in the U.S. But I think that often people are willing to consume cultures without actually embracing them. And I think you can see that especially these days when we have this sort of contentious, virulent conversation about immigration and immigrants. And yet we're willing to go to restaurants and eat their food. We're just not willing to embrace their cultures and embrace them as people. And you know, I feel like there is a role for home cooks and restaurateurs and the food industry to play to humanize immigrants and immigration.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I feel like I would love to hear your thoughts on where we can try to find this common ground and how we can use food in these productive ways to help ourselves build connections.
I think having an open mind is the best thing. The way I raised my kids was that we fed them everything. We fed them Mexican food, Chinese food, adobo. I made Filipino food all the time. Wherever I traveled, I picked up dishes and I made them for the kids. And we never said to them, finish everything. We never said that. We said, taste everything. As you go, we take a little and taste it. I just want you to taste it. So by the time they were 13, they were familiar with the cultures, because I used to tell children, my children, not stories that I read from books. I would tell them stories from history very often when they were little kids. I would read them stories about travelers, for example, who came to India and what they saw and how they went to the emperor's court. And I would tell them about people being thrown from the top of a fortress. And they were little, and I perhaps shouldn't have been telling them. But they were enamored of the history of India and the history of other places, because I told it to them as a story, as a bedtime story. I read from history a lot to them, and all encapsulated history into stories and told them. So they got very interested in the countries of the world, and now they themselves cook from every country of the world. So I think just by cooking foods from different countries, you're introducing your kids to a world, and they will be more tolerant of this world if they've had more than just plain American food. I think they are open. When they're young, they're very open. Mm-hmm. And if you show that you're open and you are happy to have this from other countries, you embrace other cultures, then they will do exactly the same. I think they learn from you at a very early age. And if you start saying, oh no, we don't eat their food, and their food is this and their food, then they will pick that up when they're very young. So I think start with the kids.
Absolutely. I have to thank my parents. I can't see where they are, but they're somewhere around here for doing just that. You know, we were never, my mother cooks delicious South Indian food.
Oh, but it was invite me any day and I'll come.
But she also makes delicious other foods as well. And
yes.
It sort of became part of the repertoire. You know, we had spaghetti some days and we'd have enchiladas another day.
Right.
And we'd have Indian food or North Indian food or something different. I feel like for a lot of people in the U.S., they're starting to make Italian food and Mexican food, but Indian food has not come to them yet as something that is simple. I think in one of your books, I can't remember which one, you say, if you make spaghetti with meat sauce, why don't you try keema with rice? It's basically the same.
That's which similar. Brings us to the book that I have just published.
Yes. Exactly. That's exactly where I was.
That was the lead in.
It was, absolutely. And I was wondering how you see bringing Indian food, not simplifying it. It's not a complicated cuisine, but helping people understand that it's not, you know, if someone said, if it were difficult, where Ted would 10 billion... You know, 10 million Indian housewives.
Oh, billion, making million, million,
however many it is. Would they be making it every day if it's that hard to make?
Yeah.
So,
well, that's what I tell people. Indians make it every day, and it's not so difficult, you know. You just have to do it. Just sit down and do it. And they're like, Indian food is like any other food. The dishes you make in 10 minutes, and the dishes that take 2 days, you know. It doesn't, there's every available kind of dish. Fast, slow, roasted, boiled, everything exists in India just like it does in any other country. If you're on a diet, use the boiled type of dishes, you know. You can do anything you want, and they all exist. And I think I have done books where I won't cut out spices, because that's the heart of our food. And when they say cut out asafoetida, I said, no, you break my heart, I can't do that. But people can get it. It's just a spice. You put salt in, you put asafoetida in. It just goes into the pot. And it gives that truffle-like flavor that some Indian dishes have that you can't get. And you're not paying for truffles, you're paying for asafoetida, which is cheap. So I encourage people to get the spices. But the cooking can be made very simple. And our simple dishes, like our rice and beans, you might call, is very simple. Mm-hmm. It's you just boil the beans, and we put turmeric so it looks yellow. And then you add some spices, and then you eat it with rice. And the Instant Pot, for those of you who think they can't make rice, the Instant Pot is magical for rice. Just don't follow the directions that come with the Instant Pot. Follow mine.
Because yes, 100%.
Because we don't like our rice al dente. All over Asia, we like our rice cooked. We don't like that hard kernel in the middle of our rice. We just want it thoroughly cooked. And for that, you take wonderful basmati rice. And you'd always know it'll be the most expensive rice. It'll be slightly brownish because it's aged a little bit. And the grains will get so long and beautiful when they are done, and they'll have a wonderful aroma. So what I do is I wash it in several changes of water, and then I soak it for half an hour. Then I drain it. Then I put it in the instant pot, push the button marked rice, and it's perfect rice. You won't go wrong with it. So there's one thing that you can make. I mean, the instant pot will make all kinds of Indian dishes, including stir-fried cauliflower, if you follow my directions. You make it, you cook it under pressure, but for 1 minute. And then you release the pressure very quickly. But you sauté, the pan can sauté. It can do all kinds of wonderful things like that. And of course, beans, dals, what we call dals, split peas, beans. They are so good in the pot because you just give them, you know, like a pressure cooker. Indians have used pressure cooker forever.
They're 40, scary 50 for a long
years.
Time.
Yeah. So all you do is put it in the instant pot, and within 10, 15 minutes, depending on what bean it is, it's cooked. And then you can season it in any way you want, and you can get a variety. You can get it tasting like Italy. You can get it tasting like Greece. You can get it tasting like India. Mm-hmm. So once you've made it, you can make it into anything. So the pot is not a magic pot, but it is a pot that allows you to learn a little bit and do the magic.
I can 100% vouch for that rice. It's wonderful. I made it the other day, and I made some dal to go with it, and it was perfect, and it was so easy. So easy my husband can do it, and that's saying
see?
A lot.
For now, he is not how a... easy can it be?
But it's not, you're right, it's not super intuitive always to know how to make these recipes.
No, it isn't. So just take not that much time. I was rushing off to do a TV series on NBC, and I was given this assignment, do this book. I said, I'm leaving. I'm going to California. And my editor said, you can do it. And she gave me 2 months. And I did it in 2 months because I said, I'm going to just master this wretched thing. I'm going to learn how it works. And I worked it this way and worked it that way. And you get on top of it, and there it is, and you can do anything in it.
Do you use it regularly now?
Yes.
And what are your favorite things? I like to know what people make when they have only a short amount of time to cook, because I only ever have a short amount of time to cook, and I like to hear inspiration for
I think something like vegetables and rice and dal, if you're doing Indian food. But if you're not doing Indian food, I mean, I do grill quite a bit. Have quick grill fish or something like that. But then the spices you put on your fish before you grill it is up to you. And again, you can go to any country and you can make it coconutty, you can make it Italian-y, you can make it Greek, you can make it anything. You just, it's the spices. I remember going to Greece and buying their wild oregano, which is so wonderful. And you buy it in like a little sheaf of dried oregano. It's wild. And then you do this on top of whatever you're cooking. I'm going to kill the mic in here. And let it put it all over the fish. And you can put good olive oil. And there it is. I'm going to have some water.
Absolutely.
it's there.
Yep. That's such a good way of thinking about it. You can sort of just explore different cuisines as you would your own.
Yes.
With Indian food, I think that part of what intimidates people is that giant spice cabinet you have to have. And
I have a cure for that. Is that when you're cooking Indian food, look at a cookbook, mine hopefully, otherwise anyone, and see which recipe you want to make. Get only the spices for that dish. Don't get every, say, I have to get the 30 spices, I have to get this, I have to get that. Don't worry about all that. Get the spices for that dish, or the two dishes, or three dishes you're making, and that's it. Then, as your repertoire increases, you get more spices. And your spice cupboard, hopefully, will never be like mine, where everything is piled like this, and I open it and do this because I don't want it to fall all over me. But I have, you know, a height in my spice cabinet. Everything's piled on top of each other. But you can start with very few and make it again and again till you're comfortable with it. and then move on to another dish, add another dish. And very often you can add very simple dishes, like we like our meals with a yogurt dish, for example. And they're both northern and southern yogurt dishes you can try. And just make that on the side, or make a chutney on the side, or make some kind of, because we like, in much of Asia, there are sambals and sauces that you eat with the food. So India has the same. We have a lot of chutneys that you have on the side. And they make every morsel taste different. So you can have this chutney with this morsel, and this other chutney with that morsel. So it's like you're going to this restaurant, then you're going to that restaurant. You're getting different things at the same time.
And are there a few things that you think sort of build your foundation for an Indian spice cupboard? The things that maybe you're going to see a lot and you should just stock up on if you want to try to make Indian food?
Well, there are certain spices that I will tell you turn to sawdust if you don't replace them. And coriander is one of them. So coriander, you should buy whole. This is the only spice, unless you're going to a shop that you know they grind them fresh and you can get a small packet and use that up, that's fine. But don't get a huge packet of ground coriander. It's best if you keep it whole. And I have my little coffee grinder, one that I use for coffee and one that I use for spices. And I just put my coriander in and you go bzzz and it's ground. And you smell that, and you smell what you have sitting in your cupboard. And they are not the same. One has a terrific aroma, mm-hmm. and one has zero aroma. It is sawdust. So I think that is one of the few spices that literally, after a few months, you throw away and get afresh. But otherwise, there's no other trick, just other than keeping spices tightly closed and away from sunlight. But after a while, red chilies will not look so red if you buy too many and they're in the cupboard for a long time. Cardamom that's in the cupboard for a long time will turn whiter and whiter from the lovely green it was once. But if you go to places like Kerala in South India where cardamom comes from, and you buy the fresh cardamom, it's so green on the outside and its aroma is so intense when you eat it. So just try and stay to the fresh side of things. You can't always be completely, you know, running to the store and getting everything fresh. So there's a little bit of a compromise as you have it for a while. But try, at least start with the fresh and get small quantities.
I like that. And I love the story of when you were at school and starting to cook and you didn't have access to fresh breads. Indian breads, and so you ate your potatoes and peas curries or whatever you were making that day with pumpernickel bread.
That's right.
And
that was great. We had I lived in a very Jewish area, so there was a wonderful, wonderful baker, Jewish baker, not far from me, just one tube stop away. And I would go there and buy all that wonderful bread that I'd never eaten before in my life, and eat that with my Indian food, because I couldn't make the Indian bread. I didn't know how to do it then.
I think that sort of demystifies things for us.
But in India,
bit.
Too, very often they will serve a meat dish, especially in Muslim communities. They will say, can I have it with a selais? And a selais is a slice of bread. So you can have anything with a slice also.
It makes it seem a lot less intimidating. You don't have to start making yourself a full Indian meal.
Yes.
You can make a side of...
Yeah, you can get it to eat gently.
Yeah.
Yes.
Make a side of Indian spiced potatoes with your roast chicken or whatever it is.
Right, exactly. That's what I always suggest. If you're making roast chicken, and I have a recipe in one of my books that when the chicken is three-quarters done, you take potatoes that are boiled, and like if a potato is this size, you cut it in half, rub it with oil, put salt, pepper, nice red chili powder, and a little turmeric, and a little cumin, a little coriander, and rub it. And this is now already boiled, so for the last quarter of the time that the chicken is cooking, you put it with the chicken, so it browns on the outside. And you have that with your roast chicken. It's delicious. Try it.
And I'm sure that there are many questions, but I have one last question for you that I'm very curious about. You are such an elegantly dressed woman, and on all your television shows, you wear these beautiful saris, and you always look so wonderfully put together. And I find that Indian cooking is like the splashiest cooking that there is. You can't make an
apron.
I never see you wearing an apron.
Not that I use them. So I have my t-shirts, my dirty t-shirts, which I will put on when I'm cooking and take them off.
Just like the rest of us.
Yeah,
I was just
like
hoping that maybe you.
Though I do, people give me wonderful aprons, and I do put them on occasionally if they're guests, but they don't last long on me. Before the guests come and I'm cooking, I'm in my t-shirt, you know. But when the guests come and I have to do last minute something, I put on an elegant apron, and it's just very rare.
So glad to hear that you are a mortal, like the rest of us, getting
turmeric under my nails.
Absolutely, always.
I imagine my mother. My mother used a perfume that was called Evening in Paris, and I don't know if it was Parisian at all, but that's what she used, and I associate her with Evening in Paris. Me, my children must associate with garlic, ginger, turmeric. All these things.
Absolutely. If anybody has questions, just if you could wait for the mic. I think Andy, wherever you went, will call on you.
You mentioned living in New York. So my question for you is, if you are cooking for yourself and your family, where do you buy your food? Do you go to stores? Or are you a green market person?
Well, my basic vegetables, unless they're Indian vegetables, we have the Union Square Market. I'm downtown, so we have the Union Square Market right next to us. And according to the season, I do shop regularly there. I shop regularly there for my fish as well, because they get it from Long Island and it's very good quality fish. My spice shopping, there's a place called Kalyustian, which is in the 30s on Lexington. And I go there for all my spices. There are cheaper places, and certainly now we're beginning to get organic spices, which you must look for. And there are other things that people should know about, like asafoetida. I've been talking so much about asafoetida. It's a resin that comes from a tree in Afghanistan and Kashmir. And it's like my husband's rosin for his violin, you know, it looks like the same thing, but it's crushed. And they have to cut it with something, so they cut it with wheat flour. So any of you who are very, very allergic to wheat, now they've started cutting it with rice for people who are allergic. So just remember that if you have those allergies, Kalyustian would be a place that would know, be aware of it. They charge much more than most people do. But they're also very careful about the things they have. And I have a recipe for garam masala. And when we were doing this book, I said, you know, people will make it or not make it, but it's nice to have the real garam masala for the recipes. That's a mixture of spices that I use. And they're all aromatic spices, like cloves, cardamom, cinnamon, nutmeg, mace, things like that. So they're now selling I don't get a cut, so don't worry. I'm not making money from it. Kalyustian is making money from it. But I like the idea of people being able to buy garam masala and not having to make it. So if you want my garam masala, just ask for it, Mother Jaffrey's garam masala. And that's only for certain dishes. You can't put it in every dish. And I love it in rice. When you're making basmati rice, and there are recipes for it, I'm sure, in the book. You stir-fry some onions in the instant pot, and then you put in your soaked rice and fry it a little bit, stir-fry gently, because you don't want to break those lovely long grains. And then you put in a teaspoon of garam masala. And it's all these aromatics, you know, the cardamom, the cinnamon. They suddenly liven up the basmati rice, and that's a wonderful thing to have. So you may want to try that.
Hi there. You mentioned asafoetida and garam masala, but do you have a preference, like a personal favorite spice or spice mix that you, when you're not feeling, when you want your comfort food, you always go for that?
No. It depends on what the recipe requires. It could be mustard seeds. It could be cumin seeds roasted and ground. So every spice, you can get different colors out of the same spice if you think in terms of paint. So, for example, cumin seed has its own taste if you just grind it. But then if you put it in hot oil and brown it, it has a taste. And then if you roast it and grind it, it has another taste. So in India, spices are really like paint. And you can mix and match and add and subtract according to the picture you want. So it's quite exciting once you get into it. But you don't have to worry about these things when you're actually cooking. Just follow the recipe.
That is good advice.
Welcome, and thank you so much for being here with us today. I just want to make a comment. I was raised a vegetarian and never really cooked meat at all. But I can tell you that I followed your lemon chicken recipe, which is an absolute knockout. I don't taste the dish. My kids love it.
Yes.
And so I just wanted to tell you that whatever you're doing, it was the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
I have
you
to tell
so
you,
much.
I thought that was my mom's recipe for years until recently she sent it to me and it was 100% from your book. So thank you for giving her that wonderful recipe.
There must be times when you absolutely hate to cook.
There are times when I always love to eat. And so to get the food I want, I have to cook it. It's a means to an end. But there are times when I'm exhausted. And my husband is a very good cook as well. So in our particular family, he takes over. And he will cook. He won't cook Indian food particularly because he says, you don't label the spices. So one day my daughter came and labeled all the spices and he still didn't. But now he's learned one dal recipe and one keema recipe, which is ground meat with peas. So he makes those two very well. And sometimes so if I'm not up to it, he will cook and cook very well.
I was wondering if you had any suggestions for cooking multiple dishes, because I'm at that point where I'm cooking that one dish and been adding it, but I haven't been able to master putting together, I guess, an Indian meal. So I don't know if there's suggestions for shortcuts or a particular way I should be preparing dishes, like in a particular order, but it's usually I'm eating cauliflower, and that's about it.
I think you're still young. I've reached the age where I don't have the energy sometimes to cook too many dishes. But I have people over for dinner. I love to entertain. So I spread it out. And I will start 2 days ahead. And there's certain meat dishes, certain dal dishes you can make a day ahead. So I just split it over several days. And I do it slowly. Because I can't do it all in one day. I just can't anymore, but I will split it and do it over several days, and I've just worked that out.
Out of your many cookbooks, do you have one that's your favorite or that you're the most proud of?
Well, they're like children, you know. You, even if you have one, you dare say it. But I don't. I think, and this is, again, because it's no longer there. There's a wonderful, I think, I did one of my finest books. It was called, that's where the age comes in. I'll tell you in a minute. Anyway, it has a red cover with me in a flowing red sari sitting on it. Taste of India. It's called A Taste of India. And it was done in England and then published here. And it's a regional book. It has several different regions of India with photographs and great descriptions of every place like Gujarat, Punjab, Bengal, different places I went to and wrote about the food. And that is very sadly out of print because that publisher is no longer there. And so because it's like an orphan little thing, I feel particularly bad about it, and I do think it's one of my best books. And you can get it every now and then at a much greater price from places where you buy old books and things like that. But that, I think, is my absolute favorite book. I think I wrote it with such joy. And as I said, the research is always the best part for me. Mm-hmm. And researching all those stories about food in Bengal, how ice first came to Bengal. They used to put, you know, when the British and Americans were trading, they would go empty to China to fill up with Chinese goods. But they needed ballast. And the ballast would be ice, which they would get from their ponds. And my husband's father remembered having ice houses and where they had the ice, they kept the ice. So anyway, this ice was then let go as they got closer to wherever they were trading in. And they let go of some of the ice in Calcutta. And so the Calcuttans would wait. The British who were in Calcutta ruling us at that time would use the ice for all kinds of dishes, and they would wait for these boats to come in. And there are wonderful stories about the ice coming in. And so I incorporate them in my books, and I certainly in Taste of India, there are all kinds of these wonderful stories. And certainly when potatoes came to India, the Indians apparently said, the white man has given us nothing good except the potato. So I love stories like, I love reading books from the 17th century, 18th century, 19th century, to pick up these stories, and I like putting them in books. So a lot of them are in that book, Taste of India. So look for it. I mean, it is occasionally available.
Following up on that, yeah. I understand you have a cookbook collection of your own. Do you have any favorite cookbooks, either, you know, instructional or historical, that you just really love?
Well, somebody asked me, Seva magazine asked me to write down a list of reference books mm-hmm. that I use. And there certainly, you can look it up on Seva.com or whatever it is. There's a whole list of books. But travel books are very important to me. And the British kept very good records of all of India, every little acre of India. They sort of kept records of what grew there, what the climate was and everything. And I consult books like that to get my background material. I found them exceedingly useful. And there are books on the history of Indian food also that I use as reference books. So I find them very important. But cookbooks themselves, how many cookbooks do I actually use? Very few. I use Julia Child. I use Marcella Hazan. Mm-hmm. I use Irene Kuo for my Chinese food. I don't know if you know the book. It's a wonderful book. I like David Tanis, who writes for The Times. I like his recipes. So I use his books. There are not too many that I turn to, but there are. There are some. And there are some that I go to for one particular recipe, you know, or another particular recipe that I've done over time. So there are other people's work. I love Marcella Hazan. I love her Italian food more than anyone else, only because she writes good books. She puts it down in a clear way that I can understand and follow. She's like Julia, and I think I'm in the same mold. I write more than perhaps I should. They're not... I don't fit four recipes on a page, you know. I write at length, so I feel I explain at length, and they explain at length. And I like that. It suits me very well.
Absolutely. I would include your book in my collection. They're really good stories, in addition to being really great recipes, which is wonderful.
Thank you.
Speaking of regional recipes, I was curious what your process is for recipes from areas that are not, you know, something you learn from your mom. So what's the process that you take on where you would sample enough so you get an idea of this is representative enough for you to write in your book?
So the last place that I did this in detail was Andhra. Which is not, I'm from the north, Andhra is south of the middle of India. So it's sort of central India, but in the south. And I was filming, doing a TV series in Sri Lanka. And on the plane back, I was sitting next to someone, and she was I said, where are you from? You know, the usual chit-chat. And she was from Andhra. And she said, you should come to Andhra. We have distinctly different cuisines in different parts of Andhra. And she started telling me about them, and I said, oh, that's wonderful to know. I know Hyderabad, I know a few places, but I don't really know all this, and I will come. I didn't go immediately, but years later, I did. And what I did was I decided that I would travel minimally on plane. Basically, we would take a car from one end of Andhra to Visakhapatnam, the other end of Andhra, and stop along the way and see everything that we could and get recipes. But then how do you arrange such a thing? It's very complicated. So you find one or two people that you know who are from Andhra, and then you ask them, can you set it up for me? Who can you set up? Then I can go to their house and learn. And so in every place from Hyderabad on east, they set up places for me where I could go. And I would be in a car sometimes, and I would jump out. And if I would see something cooking on the side of the road, I would jump out and say, can we stop? And I'll try and get a recipe right here. And so we did. We got all kinds of wonderful recipes. You know, there's so many types of dosa, but not dosa. Pancakes, savory pancakes made out of different dals. And there was this wonderful one, which is, you know, made out of moong dal. And so we stopped on the road, and you could have it stuffed with, put an egg in it, you can put something else in it, and then you roll it up and you have it, and it's so delicious. So everywhere we went, then one place we went, they said, oh, they're having nearby, they're having a chili auction. So I went to a chili auction nearby, and we went into this auction area where everything is like being on Wall Street. There's a ticker tape that's telling you what's going on, prices, things like that. And as you go in, the first thing that happens, you start sneezing. And you can't stop sneezing. And we all had little tissues with us, and they were all in shreds. And we were just dying over there because it's all chilies everywhere, and the fumes from the chilies were everywhere. But still, I was watching the auction, and watching what people were eating as snacks, because I love to know what people are eating as snacks everywhere you go. So I was making a note of that and making a note of the chilies. And then we got to Rajahmundry, and we went to one of these places, which is called a mess. And I don't know where that name came from, maybe army messes, or I don't know where. But it was a little dive that you went to underneath where they serve very cheap, for like a dollar, you can get a wonderful plate of amazing food, amazing food. So I wrote down everything that was on that menu as well. So I just go wherever I can go to get the recipes. Then I said, I want some fish from this area. So we went across the river in Rajahmundry to a little island. And on the island, there was this fisherwoman and fisherman. They both fished together. And then she made three or four dishes for us with the fish that they had caught. And it was just so wonderful to watch how they made it, how they cooked, you know, the vessels they used, how little they had. Mm-hmm. And they would keep saying, taste, taste. I didn't dare because they had so little, and I didn't want to deprive them of their food. Mm-hmm. So you just set it up before, and then you improvise once you get there. But terrible things can happen. I remember I was in Thailand going to Laos, to the Laotian end of Thailand, that northeast part of Thailand. And I had set up three young men were coming, and they said they wanted money. So I said, you know, fine, I'll give you money. And they said they would take us two different homes and give us everything we wanted over 3 days. So I was traveling at that time with an English a photographer who was married to a Thai woman. And as soon as we got there, he said to me, who are these young people who are sitting in the hotel lobby? I said, they're going to help me. I'm paying them and they're helping me. They said, this is ridiculous. We don't do that. He was speaking from pride of his wife. And he said, we don't ask people for money for things like that. You go away, he said to these young boys. And the boys left. They were like college age kids. They left. And suddenly there was nobody who was going to take me for 3 days all over this particular area and show me around. So I was just distraught. And then the waiter who was watching all this and standing behind us said, I can help you. You come to my house. He was so sweet, and he did take us. So we went with him. He took us to the market where they bought the glutinous rice that they eat. They buy it steamed already. Mm-hmm. Then he said, I'll take that home to my wife. She's cooking. She's preparing everything. And she had all the gods fed, you know, in the little garden outside. They had these little stands for their gods, and all the kitchen gods had been fed, and we walked in. And she made absolutely marvelous dishes that we had with the rice that they'd bought in the market, he'd bought in the market. And then he led us to other people, and they led us to other people. So sometimes it works itself out. But you can have terrible experiences and not get any of the dishes that you're looking for. And certainly, Andhra was great. Andhra was great. All the fried foods, and oh, God, they were so good. The same idli kind of batter.
Oh, yes.
And, oh, God, they're so just so excellent.
Yes, thank you. I just have a comment. You mentioned Julia Child, among other people, and I'm so refreshed by your manner, and I think it's so much as she was, this no-nonsense approach. I had the, not to name drop, but I will, I had the pleasure of sitting at dinner with her in San Antonio, Texas, at a food conference at a roadhouse with a rodeo at one end, and eating barbecue and drinking Shiner Bock. And she was just a very down-to-earth person, as
she
I think
was.
You do, that you are. And it just occurs to me that the people who have made impact on the way people eat are not celebrity chefs like we're overrun with now, and you know, saying you have to have this, you have to have that, but it's people like you and Julia who just really say, look, there's no magic here, there's no nonsense here, you just do what you have to do and good. So I want to thank you for
thank you for saying that.
Well, what a lovely note to end on. Thank you so much for being
thank
with
you.
Us we were
thank
so
you.
Lucky to have you here.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.